The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
You guys ready? Ready to have some... I think I'm ready. I think we're ready. We're ready. We were in a cab on the way. We came in on the train, and we made the mistake of saying, like, so, and I was very sincere in asking this. I was like, I haven't been in Philly for a while. Has anything happened recently? And I was like, making small talk, and he looked at me with a stink eye in the rearview mirror like I'd come from another planet. And he's, the Eagles, and I was like, oh. So I got to know, how many of you went to the parade? That's amazing. Like, I did not know how much overlap there was with the football-going public and the book-buying public. But now it seems like it's about 92%. That's amazing. Congratulations. That was the best Super Bowl in my lifetime, probably, I think. I love that Foles guy. I always love that Foles guy. Sorry, we're just going to talk football for the first 20 to 30 minutes and then get into coffee. Anyway, we were just in Brooklyn yesterday where... this is Mokhtar Alkanshali. I should just... Howdy, y'all. This is your first time here.
It sure is.
First time in Philadelphia.
Absolutely.
That is crazy because you grew up a little bit in Brooklyn before moving to San Francisco. And can you talk about, like, your parents came from Yemen, and your grandfather had sort of set up a little mini empire of grocery stores on the East Coast, but mostly Brooklyn, and your dad's working at one. Can you talk about what you remember of Brooklyn? You were, like, 8 when you left, but...
So we grew up in Bed-Stuy, before I became vegan. It's going to be a fun night. And it was a great childhood. My dad ran a liquor store that my grandfather had bought. And me being Muslim, my father didn't want to partake in that. You know, it was against our religion, and he wanted to find a different lifestyle for him and his kids and us. So we moved from Brooklyn to San Francisco to a neighborhood called the Tenderloin.
You guys said a lot of people know the Tenderloin. All right. Well, the Tenderloin's like a neighborhood that I've gotten to know it really well. We have a center called 826 Valencia, and it's spawned a lot of similar centers around the country, including Philly Spells here in Philadelphia. Anybody from Philly Spells? I'll pretend that everybody clapped and said yes. Woo! But, you know, writing and tutoring for kids in the city and helping the public school teachers where they are and with what they need. And but we just opened a second center in the Tenderloin. We took over a space. The city moved out a very problematic liquor store called Big Boy Liquors. And there was not just liquor sold in there. A lot of other stuff sold inside and out. A lot of open drug use inside and out. And a lot of trouble made for the neighborhood. And when you go to the Tenderloin, you walk through... and some people just drive through, and you think, oh, this is not a place for kids, because there is a lot of crime and a lot of petty crime and a lot of drugs. And but because it's one of the most affordable neighborhoods in the city, and a neighborhood that welcomed a lot of immigrant communities for the last 40 years or so, there's a lot of families there, and about 5,000 kids that live in the neighborhood that we don't think about as a haven for kids. But your dad packs up and your parents move from, you had a little bit more space in Brooklyn to a one-bedroom apartment with 7 kids in on Polk Street in the Tenderloin. What was that like?
Dave Chappelle once described the Tenderloin and said, ain't nothing tender about that place. which is somewhat true. You know, it's a very difficult reality for a kid to grow up in a place like that. A lot of violence, a lot of negative things outside, but it was also a place where there was a lot of different cultures, a lot of youth. I think there are about 4,000 youth that live in Tenderloin, and for me in that building, seven of us. Wasn't much space, but we had fun. There were our Vietnamese neighbors who played karaoke all night. And our Mexican neighbors we played soccer with in the hallways, and a lot of Yemenis that live there. And we're Yemenis, when someone goes somewhere, the whole village kind of follows them. And so they all came and lived in this building on 1036 Polk Street, in between two porn stores.
Did some of the trouble on the street seeped into some of the behavior, I guess, you get? Some of you and your friends became, you know, typical middle school and teenagers, but your parents got a little concerned about the path you were taking.
Yeah, you know.
And it doesn't help that your dad was a bus driver, driving the city, knowing where you are at any given moment, or you don't know where he is in any given moment, so.
They would change my dad's bus routes a lot. And so I was not even sure which bus he was on. And so there's a part of the book where Dave describes him as a 40-foot conscience that was fooling around the city. But as a kid, and one thing I do like about this book, I loved books as a kid. And I think books are really radical. If you think about it, you can take a book and you can escape to somewhere totally different. And with all the negativity around me, and it's very sad, I think, that when youth aren't allowed to dream or see themselves outside the box that they're in because of that circumstance. And so for me, I loved books, and I had this ghetto library, and it's not this library, in my mom's kitchen in the pantry next to her sazon Goya seasoning and olive oils. And I bought a lot of books, some I borrowed from the library indefinitely.
Yeah, I got to say, this building reminds me a lot of, you know, this intimidating and historic, beautiful building. It's a lot like the San Francisco City Hall. We had an event to kick off the book about a year and a half ago. We worked together for about 3 years on this book, and a year and a half ago, Mokhtar was like, wouldn't it be great when the book comes out, we can have an event on the steps of City Hall, and dignitaries can be there, and leaders of the Arab and Muslim communities in San Francisco, and we'll have the supervisors there. We have like a supervisor system in San Francisco, and Supervisor Jane Kim from the Tenderloin can be there, and we'll have the city librarian and everything. And everything that Mokhtar dreams, it came to pass. And so we have this event on the steps of City Hall, and Luis Herrera, who's the head of the public library, was there, and we start talking about the fact that Mokhtar may or may not have indefinitely borrowed some books from the library, and he felt really guilty meeting like the head dude. And but Luis Herrera on the steps of City Hall like absolved him of all of his fines. I think if anything else, you know, that's the best thing that can come out of all this, I guess, right?
I mean, I wanted him to, you know, do that on the record, and he did. And they actually gave me a library card the next day, so.
Clean slate.
And
yeah.
I did love books, and one book series in particular were the Harry Potter series. Shout out to Harry Potters out there. Okay. We put your wands in the air. And I think as a kid, I loved that book a lot because it had this idea that, you know, maybe I didn't belong in this family. And maybe Hagrid would come and, you know, take me out of here. But the idea that, you know, like Harry, I lived in this harsh reality, but maybe I had something else for my life, another destiny. And those are very radical and very powerful thoughts for a kid to have. And I think those thoughts stayed with me for a long time and influenced me. And eventually you're a product of your environment, and I was a quote-unquote troublemaker. And my parents just couldn't contain me, even with my father fooling around the city. And so their idea was they would take me to Yemen, sort of like a boot camp. And I would go there and meet my family and get right. And so as a kid, I sometimes felt like I didn't belong in America, especially when I left these bigger cities. And so I always grew up hearing stories about Yemen, our homeland, our family. And so as an immigrant kid, I felt like I belonged there, maybe. So I was about 12 when I went, and I get to this country, I'm like, yeah, I'm finally here, I'm home. And I do not fit in.
They know you from a mile away, the other kids your age. Like, that is not one of us.
I just couldn't walk the walk and talk the talk, and they didn't have toilets. You know, I just didn't. The whole world was different for me. It took a lot for me to try to fit in. And there's a lot of funny stories. I'll share one of them from the book. My grandmother, Zafaran, asked me to go buy a chicken for lunch. You know, and growing up in the city. And
not a cooked chicken.
Like a chicken.
A live chicken.
So yeah. I go and growing up here, we don't know where our food comes from. We go and get to see it made and processed somewhere else, and it's brought to you in this neatly packaged thing. And so I go there, and there's these live chickens, and I'm pointing at the one I want. And I'm supposed to grab it, but I didn't. So he grabbed the chicken, and he asked me a question. And so I assumed he was trying to add something on. And so I said no. He looked at me kind of weird, and he killed the chicken. And he was asking me if I wanted to take out him to clean it, to take the feathers, and I said no. So he put this dead chicken with its blood and its feathers in this bag, and he gave it to me, and I went home with it. As soon as I got to my house, my grandmother yelled and then laughed at me. And then I went to eat, because my grandfather played a big role in my life, because he was the kind of person where everyone knew his name. He dealt with a lot of tribal disputes, and he would go one morning, he'll be in the capital city, 3 hours away at him for a wedding, and then have lunch somewhere else, an hour away, to deal with a dispute or go to a funeral. So our home was a place where there was always guests. So when I went to eat lunch, my grandma, of course, came and told them the whole story and made fun of me.
What was her nickname? What was the thing that she called everybody?
She called me Dummy.
Yeah, Dummy.
That was her thing. Yeah, Dummy. And eventually, you know, I was able to... being with my grandfather and walking with him and seeing his life there, I was able to walk the walk and talk the talk and understand Yemen that way. And that really influenced me a lot and helped me learn things that, you know, when I later on go back to work in coffee, being able to, you know, speak Arabic without any accent and fit in really helped me a lot.
Well, you come back to San Francisco and you... This is, you know, you're growing up in the shadow of 9/11, and from a pretty young age, you became a fairly prominent young activist and sort of, I guess, interacting between the Arab and Muslim communities and City Hall and, you know, addressing some of the overly broad, you know, federal policies toward the Muslim community in the city. And even in San Francisco, there was, like, some real... problematic intrusions into the mosques, and I wonder, how did you get involved in that, and how did that, what did you see for yourself as a teenager, like going to college, or what kind of career were you thinking?
I think that we're all a product of our environment and the times that we live in. And so being Muslim and being Arab post 9/11, it was a very difficult reality. And like other communities have gone through and are still going through issues, what happened to Japanese Americans in World War II and African Americans then and now, Native Americans. And so there's a unfortunate negative legacy in this country. And so for me, it forced me to be in a place where I tried to help. So oftentimes I would be a translator between really wonderful organizations that I worked with, like the ACLU and the Asian Law Caucus and the Council on American Islamic Relations. And I found myself in this space and I thought I was very useful. And I thought I could find a path in life, and that would be a lawyer. And my parents liked that idea. And so I decided I would be a lawyer, and everything I did was around that idea, to finish undergrad and go to law school, and then maybe get involved in local politics and do something like that.
When we met, you were working as a doorman at the Infinity Residential.
They called
tower.
Us lobby ambassadors.
Lobby ambassador.
So it's a difference. But.
And, you know, it was, I've been working with high school students for the last 16 years in San Francisco, writing many hundreds of college recs. And we have an organization called Scholar Match that tries to get first in their family students into college and through college. And I know firsthand from so many of my students just how hard it is when they're first, because Mokhtar's oldest in his family, first in his family, not coming from a college-going family culture,
And in California, the ratio of college counselors to public school students is 945-1. True story. And that's not just college counselors. That's actually school counselors that they have to do with everything, all the emotional well-being of the kids and college counseling. So they're up against it. These counselors are doing heroic work, but there's not enough of them. So a lot of kids fall through the cracks and don't get the help they need. And so they end up, like Mokhtar, like cobbling together credits at City College. And Mokhtar went down to Bakersfield Community College for a while and did a semester there. But when we met, you're working at the Infinity. And what was that like? This is like one of a brand new tower, downtown San Francisco, sort of symbol of the new San Francisco. And you're working the desk and have to wear a tidy little blazer and look sharp and open doors for these folks all day.
It sucked. You know, I think in life you need to be able to produce something, and sitting around all day you're not producing much. Especially at that time, I started to read these really heavy books, like Das Kapital and books by Frantz Fanon. And
at the desk, you're reading Das Kapital. the image I love.
I did, actually. It was like a printed spiral. It wasn't even an actual book. And, you know, I'm learning about the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, and I'm looking out. And the people that live there are very wealthy people, you know, and it was somewhat very dehumanizing, you know, the way they treated us. Because they wanted us to open the door for every single person. So whatever you were doing, you know, if you were helping with a package, you had to have a sort of sixth sense. And when someone came to the door, they're coming or leaving, you had to just stop what you're doing, rush up over there, but then you had to compose yourself and then open the door, you know, and greet them. And they were on their phone, they didn't even see you, but that didn't matter. And what made it suck so bad was that there was an actual button at the desk that opened the door. Like, it actually opened, but that wasn't the point.
Quicker than you could open it yourself, and both doors could open, and this beautiful gateway for them, but that wasn't the point.
No, and so it was a low point, I can say. And again, like, this, especially with me and these dangerous ideas I had read in books of trying to do something bigger with my life.
Well, then one day, you've got a friend named Miriam. So Miriam's family owns Ted's Market, which is Ted's Deli, which is down south of Market, maybe half a mile away. And she had gone, she finished college, but she was doing a lot of deliveries for her dad. And so some of her deliveries took her to the Infinity. And it was this text message that sort of turned it all around.
It's really interesting. Somehow, sometimes in life, it can be these small things that have these, you know, amazing butterfly effects that take you on paths and journeys you would have never thought of. And for me, it was as simple as this text message of a weird Yemeni man, a statue of a man drinking coffee. Raise your hands if you've heard of a company called the Hills Brothers.
It's like, it's such a generational
thing. None of the young people have their hands raised. It's an old San Francisco coffee company. And San Francisco was a very important port for coffee. All the coffee that came through the Panama Canal from Colombia and Brazil landed there. So you had these really powerful coffee dynasties, like the Folgers family and the Hills Brothers. And around that time, in the 1900s, there was this love for Islamic motif in architecture. You know, there were buildings that have these, like the Shriners building in Chicago, which is now Bloomingdale's. In SF, you have a few buildings like the Alcazar on Gary Street, or even the Fairview Building Clock Tower. It's based off of a minaret in Seville, Spain. And the Hills Brothers, they took this statue, this symbol of an Arab or Ethiopian man, you know, and drinking coffee. So I read that text, and I had been working there for about a year. So I crossed the street. It was literally across the street from where I sat. And there was this giant statue of this muscular-looking Arab man holding a cup of coffee to the sky. And he had this turban, and he had this beard, and this long robe with flowers on it, something that an Arab man would never wear. And I just saw that, and I began to research and learn about coffee, and I learned about this amazing, incredible history of coffee that I knew nothing about.
Did you know that, well, I'll spoiler here, coffee did not start in Colombia or Java or some of the places that we would think it started in, and there's still a debate whether it began in Ethiopia or Yemen, and you're in the middle of all this research, and did you take a side?
So depending on which side of the Red Sea you live on, there's a different decision to whether or not coffee begins in Ethiopia or Yemen. And I think I'm probably the only Yemeni who thinks coffee began in Ethiopia.
Are there Yemenis here? Anybody?
I know someone clapped over here, but I look at things historically and scientifically, and the amount of coffee and diversity and genetics is unbelievable in Ethiopia. But they didn't make coffee there. It grew wildly. They would chew on the cherries. For those who don't know, coffee comes from the ground. It's a shrub, and it comes in these beautiful cherries. And they're, you can see some right there. And inside those cherries, there's two seeds, and those seeds are coffee beans that when they're roasted and brewed, they make this wonderful drink that will change your life. At this point, I wanted this to be a little bit more interactive, so you can grind, that's what you do good.
I don't do it well, but I'm going to do it.
Let me give you some coffee first.
Oh, I thought you already put it in. All right,
and then you'll get there.
I can't be trusted with any of this process.
All right. And so it's an incredible history. I learned that for those who don't know, there's a city, a port called Mocha, and that's where the name comes from, and it's in Yemen. So the first people who actually cultivated coffee intentionally and who harvested it and roasted it and made this wonderful drink were these Sufi monks who lived in Yemen in the 1400s. And for those who don't know, I am not the monk of Mocha. That is a man named Abdul Qadir al-Jaziri, Sheikh Ali ibn Umar al-Shadhili. And he lived in Mocha in the 1400s. And he's credited with writing the first book on coffee. And for them, coffee was a very powerful spiritual drink. They believed that God had brought down this drink to help us reach higher states of consciousness. Right? And it's true. And so I wanted to recite some poems from this book that when I first heard them and read them, really impacted me. He said what could be translated as, "O coffee, O story of lovers, you helped me repel away my sleep. You helped me stay awake and worship my Lord while people fell asleep. Don't blame me for my intense love for coffee. It is the drink of the righteous people." And that it is. And so when I heard those words, I was so really inspired, and I began to research more about coffee and what it was and how it spread. So in that time period, it was actually illegal to sell green seedlings to foreigners. So the only coffee that they sold was coffee that was baked or boiled so that the embryo in it would die and you couldn't grow it again. And if you did sell coffee to a foreigner that could be grown, you'd be executed by Yemeni authorities. It's a monopoly. Here you go.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is it still loud?
You can go, man.
All right.
And so
I don't know why it's going to be quieter over here. I just got a microphone. I'm going to hide behind.
I think there's a microphone.
Curtain and
there's a microphone on you, so it doesn't.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, so how coffee left Yemen and got to us today here in Boston? It's a wonderful and amazing story.
Philadelphia.
I mean, in Philadelphia. So.
Wait, what did he say? I was over there. You said Boston.
So if you can see me in the back, I'm turned very red and blushing. Yeah. And it's very hard for a brown man to blush. But let me get some coffee in me for, and you'll see. And so how coffee got to Philadelphia here, and to Boston, and to New York, from Yemen. There was an Indian Sufi named Baba Budan who loved coffee so much, he was willing to risk his life for it. And so the story goes that he took seeds and he smuggled them in his underwear and made it to India with them and grew them there. And his shrine is still located in the south of India. And the other story was of the Dutch VOC, East India Company, that opened up shop in the year 1616 in Philadelphia, no, in Mocha. And they were able to smuggle out, the story goes, 7 seeds out of Yemen. And they took it to one of the colonies on the island of Java in Indonesia. From there, and that's where the name Java comes from. So Java and Mocha were the first places where coffee was exported. And from there, coffee has a very pretty dark history, because when coffee did leave Yemen, everywhere it was grown, people were enslaved to grow it. And so eventually the French and Dutch had a peace treaty, and the Dutch gifted a coffee tree to the French. And in 1721, a Frenchman by the name of Gabriel Duclos took cuttings from that and crossed to the Atlantic Ocean. On the way, they were first robbed by Algerian pirates. Shout out to any Algerians here. And then they began to ration out their water and food. So Gabriel Duclos gave up most of his water supply to this coffee plant he had in his glass box. Eventually, they made their way to the Caribbeans, and in Martinique, they began to grow coffee there. From there, coffee reached Haiti, and at one point, Haiti produced half the world's coffee. And when the Haitian people fought for their self-determination and freedom from the French, the retreating French burned most of their crops. Eventually, coffee made its way to Central South America. And that one tree that made its way to Martinique is called the Noble Tree. And something around 90% of the world's coffee is traced to that one tree. From 7 seeds from Indonesia, from Yemen, and Ethiopia. And in science, this is called, in biology, genetic bottleneck. When you have countries like Ethiopia and Yemen with so much diversity in cultivars and varieties, and outside of them, they're very limited. And when a disease is prevalent, and if it can decimate entire populations of coffee, such was the case in 2013. Because of climate change, conditions allowed for a disease called laroya, or coffee leaf rust, to come about. And countries like El Salvador lost 75% of their coffee production. And Guatemala, over 50%, to the point that the Guatemalan government issued a national state of emergency. And so there's a couple of fun facts about this time, and it's really incredible because coffee changed the world. When coffee houses entered Europe, it completely brought about intellectual and creativity and to a level that had never been seen before. Because before coffee, the main drink was alcohol, and people were always drunk.
So in these, generally speaking. Yeah.
Generally. So in these coffee houses that sprung up in Vienna and London and Paris and here, for the first time, people had public discourse without any class barriers. And they were incredible places. There were some that were known for musicians, and some that were known for philosophers, and some for politicians. And a lot of amazing revolutions happened in these coffee houses, the American, French, and Russian revolutions. The Boston Tea Party was planned in a coffee house called the Green Dragon. And the two fun facts, because there's so many of them, and I can talk about this for a long time, but you guys eventually have to go. But I do suggest you read about this. There's a really great book that talks about the history of coffee. It's called The Monk of Mocha. And you guys should check that out. But so in 1475, the first coffee house opens in Istanbul called Kivhana. And under Turkish law in that year, a woman had the right to divorce her husband if he didn't give her daily quota of coffee. Yes, priorities. In the year 1600, Pope Clement VIII, he banned coffee. He called it an evil Mohammedan drink. He actually put in a Muslim ban against coffee, like some people, and which we'll get to later. And eventually, the traders persuaded him to try it. And this is documented. You can research it. There's probably books upstairs. When after he had his first few sips, he fell in love with coffee so much that he baptized the beans. and then coffee spread from there around the world. And Now coffee is the second most consumed drink after water and one of the most traded commodities after oil. And I always say that oil powers factories and machines, and coffee powers humans and dreams. And that's where I have to stop on the history part, because I can keep going.
Well, you did all this research, and then, and this is the part I can't, it's hard to, I think, for a lot of people to wrap their heads around. Mokhtar was only 26, and you decided to go back to Yemen, and not just like be a historian of coffee, but actually decide to be a coffee cultivator, farm organizer, exporter, and resurrector of the ancient art of Yemeni coffee and its position as the world's best coffee. And you've never been to a coffee farm at this point, right?
No.
this couldn't be it's, too hard.
It's, I, after that, I walked into a coffee shop, and especially coffee shop, and I had a cup of coffee from Ethiopia. And it was $4.75, which at the time I thought was expensive for coffee. But I bought it, and I drank it. And you know, before that, the only coffee I was used to was coffee. Fun fact, I didn't drink much coffee 5 years ago. But when I did have that coffee from Ethiopia, the first thing I noted when I tasted it was it didn't taste like the burnt popcorn that I was used to. You know, you had to put lots of cream and sugar just to make it drinkable. And you mostly used it for cramming for exams or driving late night. This coffee I tasted had notes, it tasted like blueberries and honeysuckle. It had this like very sweet lingering aftertaste. And I didn't know coffee could taste like that. And so after that, I started talking to a barista. And in my case, it was a very nice barista. The thing with baristas is there's so much that goes between the farm to us that if they're not patient, you know, with explaining that process, they can sound pretentious and snobby. So he began to tell me about the coffee and how it's from this one area called Yirgacheffe in Ethiopia. It's grown at 1,800 meters above sea level, and it's a special varietal and processing method. And really what stuck to me is that he told me that they had a direct relationship with this community in Ethiopia. And because of that relationship, the quality of the life of these farmers was greatly improved. So I thought that was pretty amazing. And I began to research coffee, and I wanted to know more about coffee. And so there's actually an exam called the Q grader exam. Raise your hand if you are a Q grader in the audience. Oh, none tonight. But it's
only 4,000 in the world, so it's, I guess odds are.
It's a 22-part exam, and you have to basically like one of our exams, we had to memorize 36 smells for coffee. And it's a way to calibrate your taste buds with people around the world and the language you learn. And so they have these things called coffee cuppings or tastings.
So it's really, I have to say, when we met again, we knew each other before, and then Mokhtar went to Yemen and came back. And when we met again, it was outside the Blue Bottle in Oakland, and they were having a coffee cupping. And I've come from Chicago in the 70s where we didn't know fresh food, and I didn't see a fresh vegetable until I moved to San Francisco, I think, and that's an exaggeration, but not by much. And but I'm also just inherently skeptical of pretense around food, and I see all these people at a table a lot bigger than this, and they've got a clipboard in one hand and a pen, and there's too many hands because I'm going to name a few more things that they have, but it doesn't work. They have a spittoon around one finger, I think, and then a spoon, and they're going from cup to cup and slurping.
Can you just...
I'm going to try. Mokhtar's going to do it right in a minute. But that's what they're doing, as loud as you can imagine. And like 20 people with their clipboards and they're slurping, but they're not drinking the coffee, they're spitting it out. And then they're washing the spoon, and then they're doing another, you know, sample. And they're doing this, and it's the most ludicrous thing anybody could ever imagine. And it's all about coffee. And I thought, I'm in the wrong place, and this is absurd. And but what I ended up realizing, like even that day, because we spent a few hours outside talking and also explaining what was going on in there, is that The cupping, it's like a, you know, it's on a 100-point scale, and it's a very intricate system. But instead of like trying to just be an elitist system to elevate the 4,000 people that are the sommeliers of coffee, it's actually trying to create a level playing field where the producers know how good their coffee is. So a producer in Panama can say, huh, this is, they do the same training that anyone else would do for, whether you're in Tokyo or Stockholm or Philly, and then you have the same scale, and you can say, wow, this is very good coffee. This is an 87, so that's a specialty coffee. I can charge more for that than I would otherwise if it was like a lower grade commodity coffee. And so for centuries, you had this thing where the producers didn't have power. It was the buyers and the consumers that had the power to say, this is what the coffee is going to go for. It's going to go for a buck a pound or $1.50 a kilo. This is what you're going to be paid. But now with the Q grading, as absurd as it looks, and as sort of elitist as it seems, is actually the lever of power for the farmers on the ground to say, I've got a specialty coffee here. I know what the market will bear for this. I'm going to deal directly with a roaster in Chicago or a roaster in London, and I'm going to dictate a price for them. And so you flip the power dynamic almost instantly. So I was educated a little bit that day. By the way, I'm going to hand out some coffee, so raise your hand if you want some.
Oh, my God.
That would have been really bad.
And so it's a very, I mean, when I walked into my first coffee tasting.
Oh, man.
We're going to pick a number from, no.
All right.
And I walked into my first coffee tasting, and I didn't know much about it. By the way, let me show you how it sounds. You're supposed to slurp it very aggressively. The more your mother would disapprove, the better. And you want the coffee to be basically like vaporized around your mouth and all over your mouth so you can taste all the different notes. And this is how you're supposed to do it.
That's like minimum volume so that it's supposed to be.
Delicious coffee. So
did you
it's
hear
incredible.
Mokhtar just said delicious coffee about his own coffee.
You do this and you do it, you have to have a poker
face.
That
might be all I got.
Because you don't want to influence the person next to you. Because if I say I taste chocolate, no, now you taste chocolate. You know, so you go around, you slurp like this, and you write your notes down for about 45 minutes or so. And then after that, you begin to discuss and talk about the coffee you taste. So the first time I went to one of these things, I started hearing weird descriptions for coffee. This girl, she said, this coffee tastes like pink Starburst. And this other guy, he said, this coffee has a hint of baby carrots.
Just a hint.
And then the one that really lost me, he looked me straight in my eyes and said, this coffee, it's just too passive aggressive for me. And I looked at it, and I'm like, yeah, totally. I totally see that. It absolutely is. And, you know, I just tasted coffee. Yeah. So one thing I didn't know much about was coffee is not one homogeneous thing. There's the different cultivars in coffee, and varietals. Just like anything, in apples, we have Granny Smith and Pink Lady and Fuji and Washington Red, and, you know, and each one tastes different. In coffee, you have these incredible varieties. Catuai, Catora, Bourbon, Geisha, Tipica, and each one tastes different. It can be influenced by its elevation, the terroir around it, and so it's not the same, which is important because we oftentimes see coffee as this cheap thing we just buy and, you know, slurp it down for caffeine and keep going, but it's not. It's an incredible process it takes to get these coffees picked and to when we first started, we went to one of our, this is not in Yemen, this picture. It's in a coffee farm, the only mainland coffee farm in the US, in Santa Barbara, California. And we went there together.
I had to see, I'd been reading also about the process of picking and cultivating coffee and all the steps that go into it. But we had to sort of go and see what it was like to pick it. And as you can see, on a bough, like if you're picking grapes, you're picking the whole bunch, right? And they're generally all ripe and at the same time. But with coffee, you need just these ruby red ones because they have to be relatively standard in what you're going to process and brew to have them be ripe. But you see on the same bough, You have bright green ones, you've got yellow ones, you've got orange ones, pink ones. And so the picker actually has to choose each cherry. And one by one, and it takes a little twist and a tug to get each one down. And so it's incredibly laborious. But we spent a few hours in the hot sun in Santa Barbara picking. We had our, you know, our basket on the side, and we're sort of doing the work alongside the regular pickers on this farm, and we've been doing it for a long time. And after a while, you feel like you've got the hang of it. I'm picking and twisting and putting. I'm like, okay, this isn't so hard. I've got a bunch of cherries. And I look down, I've got like 9 cherries after 2 hours. And the math of it just no longer worked, because you think it's so laborious and it takes such discernment to get it right. And that's the first step. And then, cultivating the plant in the first place is the first step. But then the picking is the first step. And then there's the processing. And then there's the sorting. And then sorting again, roasting. I'm not even getting close to the number of steps. I wrote them in the book, and now
it's really unbelievable. And you know, and so coffee is not this one simple thing. You know, you look at other things like cheese. If I say Velveeta, and then I say 4-year-old Kumte, and wine, if I say, you know, Boone's Farm or Tubuk Chuck, right? But then you have a special vine from Napa or from Chile or from France. And so in coffee, it's the same. And there's incredible amounts of labor that bring out very unique, exquisite coffees. And you guys are lucky. You guys here have La Colombe. It's an incredible coffee company that does all the work for you. Yes. They have what's called a green buyer. And they do what's called direct trade, something this book talks a lot about. They have someone who builds relationships with producers around the country, around the world. And they spend like half the year traveling to Indonesia and El Salvador and Kenya, looking and talking and meeting with farmers and trying to do this kind of work. And so unfortunately in Yemen, it's really hard to get people to go there and get green buyers out there. And when I first got into coffee, I met a lot of people who knew about Yemen coffee. And what was the best, how did they describe
it? There was an article in the 90s that referred to Yemeni coffee as the Uncle Rodney of coffee. And you invite Uncle Rodney to Thanksgiving, and you do, but you just, you know, you mean well, but you don't know which Uncle Rodney you're going to get. You know, is he going to be like the charming, nice uncle, or is he going to be the raging, drunk, crazy Uncle Rodney and ruin your holiday? And so, there was an inconsistency that was considered typical of Yemeni coffee, where it could be either the best coffee you ever had, or of a generally low grade and inconsistent.
And they would mostly say that it was inconsistent, no traceability, are these defects, and very expensive. But the best cup of coffee I had was a coffee from Yemen, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. So my idea was, how can I replicate that one cup that they talked about? So I went to Yemen. And it's really, it's hard for me to explain how amazing this country is. This picture can tell you a little bit about it. You know, these villages that are on the rooftops of mountains, kissing the skies. And they have these beautiful terraces that they've developed for centuries to produce their produce and their coffee. And they live a really uninterrupted lifestyle. And I got to go and meet these wonderful farmers. And this is what community that this coffee we're having tonight is from. And they were really incredible people. They were so welcoming, so hospitable. They would have one person from every family line up in front of me, and they would do a lottery system to see who gets to host me. And they would go out their way and get even a loan to buy a lamb and try to be as generous as a host as possible. And if you tried to give them money, it was a sign of huge disrespect. And so I was really taken away by how wonderful the people were in Yemen. And as I traveled, you know, I wrote down things like elevations and harvest patterns and varietals. But I got to hear their stories and meet these incredible people.
What was the state of the farms that you found? Like, it had been, the general Yemeni coffee trade had declined greatly. It was just a shadow of its former self in terms of the quantity shipped out and the quality. And even the processing, I mean, the choosing, everything had sort of had changed drastically. And I wonder, what did you find? And from, you were still a novice at this, What could you tell them in that first trip? And how did they see you? Did they have any faith that you as a 26-year-old American? I don't know. What did they make of you?
So my grandfather, he told me not to make promises and to tell people that I was a student so they wouldn't think I had money, you know? And so I had to walk this fine line of being like, I'm not being an idiot, but knowing something about something. And so in the beginning, there were times where I slipped up a few times. I'll share one story that you guys will like from the book. My first visit to Coffee Farm, I get there, and when we got to this farm, and they're looking at me, and anyone from the outside, they think they can see the matrix and things, you know? And so I'm over there looking at this tree and, you know, touching the leaves, and I don't know anything about it. And so after about a few minutes of me doing that, one of the cooperative leaders comes up to me and says, Mukhtar, I'm sorry to bother you, but the coffee tree is actually over there.
What was it? It was an olive tree?
It was like an olive tree. And, you know, and my inner city skills came out, and I was like, I understand that, Muhammad, but it's in close proximity to the coffee trees and it affects its health. Which is actually true, but I didn't know that at the time. And so early on, I had to be quiet and just like try to observe and learn as much as I could. And so I did, but they were picking coffees. You see on the left here, you shouldn't pick coffee cherries like that. You know, you're supposed to wait until they fully ripen. And so I remember seeing that, and I asked the farmer, I said, hey, you know, if I paid you more money, would you just pick these ripe red cherries? Because it does take more effort to do that, to selectively pick just the ripe red ones. And he said, if you paid me more money, I would pick rainbow colored cherries for you. And so doing that kind of work with them and on the ground, and the way they were so picking incorrectly, they were drying down the floor of rooftops, you know, which there's not much airflow, and there's dirt and gravel and chickens poop. A lot of funky things happen. And so then it was mixed. Sometimes they would store coffee for like 5 years. Oh, this is one of my favorite pictures. Most coffee farmers in Yemen have never really tasted their coffee the way we drink it. And so I had them try their coffee for the first time, and this was a tasting with their coffee, a Sumatran, and Ethiopian. And I didn't tell them that their coffee was on the table. So at the end, I asked them, which one do you guys like the most? And they all picked their coffee. And at the end, when I lifted the cup and they saw the names, they were so proud and happy. And, you know, you can see, especially that guy in the middle, Khalid. But it was this incredible feeling of self-worth. And so I saw that they were doing this kind of work. And before coffee, I was involved in community organizing. And so I put my community organizing hat on, or my kid's turban, and I began to work with them on ways to do that. And we had this kind of quality and social intervention program, where on the quality side, we helped them build raised drying beds to dry it more evenly. And we gave them things like moisture analyzers, to the tools that they can help them improve their coffee. On the social side, making sure that there was gender equity, because 75% of the farmers were women. And in the villages, women have much more agency than men. It's more matriarchal in Yemen. They own a lot of the land, and men mostly work in the cities or in the diaspora abroad. And I mandated that half the board members had to be women in the cooperatives. And so when I did that, the quality of the coffee literally changed overnight. And I remember one time walking by with some of the men and seeing these baskets of perfectly picked red cherries. And I would tell the men, look, this is why women live longer than you. And so doing this work and seeing this really incredible country, and you know, when we think of Yemen, we don't think of a wonderful, lush, green place. This is another one of my favorite pictures. You can see these beautiful terraces. Those are all coffee trees. And if you look closely in the top, in the corner there, that's actually a village, the second hill. You know, I lost about 40 pounds in that first summer. I had also contracted malaria and tapeworms, but you'll read about that. And that's me trying to look like a brown Indiana Jones.
Well, you get all these samples and you come back to the U.S. with them. You have 21 samples from regions all over Yemen. And with your coffee mentor, a Dutchman named Willem Boot, living in California, you test these samples. How do they do?
So from the 21 samples I brought back, 19 failed basic standards. Actually, Willem called a few of them DOA, death on arrival. And so they had a lot of problems because of the way it was picked and processed and mixed, and all these things had happened. But two of those coffees had a 90-plus rating, which is the highest you can give a coffee. And so I felt there was something special there. And I went back to Yemen. I took more samples from those areas, and they were horrible. So I realized the way it was picked and processed was all incorrect. And so that's when I began this social equality model. And we began that harvest, and things were going pretty good. There were a lot of difficult political instability going around me. But I was really just focused on this project, and I just kind of chose not to look at what was happening and ignore it. But eventually that caught up with me.
You were staying in Sana'a with family, and you had the processing mill for Mokhtar's coffee was in the capital. And so you're, at this point, buying tons of coffee, bringing it to the capital, processing it. You've got a team of women working in terms of processing and sorting. And at a certain point, the Houthi rebels come from the north of the country, take over the capital. And I wonder what that was like to live through that, not just the Houthi takeover, but what happens next with the Saudis.
I remember that night. It was March 25th, 2015, and I woke up to, I was supposed to leave a few days after that to this coffee conference here in Seattle, which we'll get to in a bit. And I remember hearing these loud explosions around me, and so I went outside to see what was going on. And I saw, it looked like laser beams that were being shot in the sky. And those were anti-aircraft machine guns that were being shot at Saudi fighter jets. So I went online to see what was happening, and it turned out that Saudi Arabia had began a military campaign, a coalition with 10 other countries to target this rebel group. And they were bombing all around us. And so I grew up, you know, the only thing I knew of war was from books and movies. I never thought ever being a place where I would experience it. And it was really just a violent reality. You know, these blasts, there's no pattern to them. They're very sporadic, and they'll be really close to you and then far, and you hear your women and children screaming, and you hear feel the ground shake, and it's very scary not to know if you won't see the morning, to actually feel death and to have to send messages to people, your family and friends, and you know, sending and not knowing if they would see you again and say things that you wouldn't normally say, and ask certain people to forgive you. For me, it was my mother, and I remember. After about an hour of this or so, it was the call to prayer for the dawn prayer. And so, for me, I believe in God, and call him or it the Force or Yahweh or Allah. It's really liberating to be able to let go and know you're not in control. You know, sometimes statistics and facts can get you so far. So I decided to go to the mosque, and we were praying there, and the imam led the prayer, and he began making supplication to God, and at a point he began asking God to forgive us for our sins, and people would just start weeping and crying. And after a while, and the blasts were still happening. You can still feel the airstrikes and just the dirt coming on your heads from the ceilings. After a while, it was like this peaceful, tranquil feeling everyone felt, and you know, and that we just submitted that we didn't know, that we decided that we're not in control, and it's a way to hold on to something, to continue. Because in those circumstances, there's not much to hold on to. It's not much light. And so I was still trying to continue my work while this was going on. And I was in my coffee lab trying to taste these coffees. And, you know, I don't like guns. I don't own any guns in the U.S. But in Yemen, it's a different reality. Here, each of those cups represents a different village I'm working in. And outside, I hear machine guns and explosions. And so I tried to leave through a different port. It's called Aden or Aden.
Well, first, the first idea is that you have a plane ticket out of Sana'a, but the airports have been bombed. And there's thousands of Yemeni Americans in Yemen at this point. The embassy had closed up some weeks before. But what do you find? Like, you expect that the U.S. will give you some way to get out.
Yeah, they bombed both civilian airports and both ocean ports, enacted a no-fly zone, and really just there was no way out the country. And so I thought, I'm a U.S. citizen. I pay taxes. I contacted the State Department, and their official response was, I'm sorry, we can't help you right now. We can relay your messages to your loved ones via our website. And I was really angry and just saddened and frustrated. And I saw other countries with less resources, like India and Pakistan, taking out hundreds of citizens, even Djibouti. And it was bad when I read a headline that said, Somalia is now evacuating citizens out of Yemen. And our government decided to leave us there. And so a few of the civil rights organizations that I was working with, we set up a website, stuckinyemen.org, which we actually had over 600 people, American citizens, sign up. And it was just, you know, I was just really angry and saddened that that happened, but I realized that I wasn't going to be rescued, and I had to find a way to make it to this conference.
Well, at this point, the citizens that were in the capital, there's still millions of people in Sana'a, and it's considered relatively safe compared to other parts of the country, especially near Houthi positions and assets. And but so a lot of people are sheltering in place, staying in their apartments. There's still some semblance of daily life going on in Sana'a. But Mokhtar has this coffee conference to go to, the SCAA conference in Seattle. And we worked on this book almost 3 years. And for about half of that time, I could not get through my head why he would leave the safety of the city, relative safety, that is, to go through active war zones all the way through down to the port of Aden for a coffee conference. And he didn't understand why. I couldn't see why that was the most logical thing to do, and I couldn't, and he, I couldn't see why he couldn't see it was the most ludicrous thing to do. But so twice, Mokhtar picked up with just carrying suitcases of coffee samples and crossed multiple Houthi checkpoints and then into territory held by militias called popular committees down in the south. And they held Aden, which is an active war zone. And he's trying to first go out through Aden and is repeatedly held at gunpoint and threatened with his life. And then comes back to Sana'a, just narrowly escaping with his life. And at that point, I think, well, of course, that's when you stay in Sana'a and forget the coffee conference in Seattle, right? And but the next day, Mokhtar hears about another way to get out, which is through the port of Mocha. Do you want to sort of explain what happens then?
You know, I didn't know that he had this issue for a long time. Until recently, we were being interviewed, and he said that to the interviewer, and I didn't know, but... and now, looking at it that way, I see why and how that can sound that way. But for me, these were real people. These are people that I know, and I promised them something. You know, at this point, we were Facebook friends.
You and the farmers.
Me and the farmers. Hashtag awkward. No. And also, like, that was what I wanted to do in my life, and I put so much into it, and that's what I had to live for. If I took that out, what else was I going to do? And so I had to attend the Specialty Coffee Association of America's conference.
To present the coffee.
Because
there's
a place, it's like a coffee Olympics. It's where people from all over the world come, and they do incredible work there. Actually, that year, Todd Carmichael was there, founder of La Colombe. And so I wanted to go to this conference and showcase this coffee. And so I heard about the port of Mocha, and I was really excited because I wanted to visit the port. I wanted to see the grave of this monk and his old mosque, and I got to go and see it, and see the historian of Mocha, who talked about the history of the city. And we were supposed to take, they told us, a mid-sized ship with about 160 passengers from Somalia and about 13 or so tons of onions. I said, okay. We get there, and the ship wasn't working, and there was no diesel, and there were going to be airstrikes the next day. That was like a small window I had to leave.
To make sure that you got, not just to the conference on time, but had time to roast the beans and let them rest.
Yeah.
All right, so I just had to say that.
When you roast coffee, it's important to let it degas and rest for a few days. Otherwise, you'll taste the roasty. Okay, right. So then I went to the water, and they said that instead of a 3-day journey with a ship, you could take a smaller boat. called a viper. It'll take one day to cross the Red Sea. So in my mind, when I heard that, I thought they meant fiber. Viper, like Dodge Viper, but he meant fiber as in fiberglass. And so I got there and there was a small, this is my now getaway selfie. But it was a small boat, you know, and it had this little single motor Yamaha on it. And, you know, we hear stories of people who take these ocean voyages from East Africa and North Africa and Syria. And we hear about these horrific scenes, these bodies that wash up in Italy and in Greece. And no one leaves land, as Orson Chire once said, no one leaves land to go on ocean unless the whole city is fleeing. And it's a very difficult place to be in, to put your life like that, in that position. So I remember calling my, texting my brother what to tell my mother and my family. I didn't tell anyone I was doing this. And then I remember going on that boat and crossing that. We made it through to Djibouti, my samples. And then from there to Kenya and Amsterdam. In Amsterdam, I finally called my mom. I told her what happened in the boat. And, you know, and she's like, did you make it? I told her, no, mom, I died. And talked to you on your phone, but she was very emotional. And so I eventually made it to the conference, and the coffees did really incredibly well. And these blind tastings, no one knew where the coffee was from, and they had the highest score on the table.
Well, then there's the catch is not to get out with just a few samples, which you did, but for the next couple of years, you have to, not that long, almost a year, you have to figure out how to get actual quantities of coffee on a container, on a ship, so that you can actually sell it. Samples are one thing, but if you're really going to change lives, you need to get a container out. And we were working at this point, we didn't know the ending, because we didn't. It could have been just that here's a man with a dream. He leaves Yemen with a few suitcases of coffee, and that's the end. And but one day, Mokhtar says, the coffee's on the water. And he calls me, and he says that, you know, in an active war zone, humanitarian crisis, when they're having so much trouble getting medicine and food into Yemen, they managed to get a container of coffee out. And but this is like going to change the lives of all these farmers and sustain them in a way outside of humanitarian aid. And it makes its way around and up the coast of California. And there's an app that you can have that you use that shows you a little icon of where the ship is at any given time. And so one day Mokhtar says, we're going to have a party. The ship's coming in on Saturday. Come on over. At this point, spoiler alert, Mokhtar had rented an apartment on the 32nd floor of the Infinity residential tower with the express purpose of seeing the ship come in. And so month to month, let's make that point, too. And so I think, okay, Saturday night, all of Mokhtar's friends are notified, family and everything. And we got it on the calendar, and all of his friends have it on the calendar. Nobody's working that day. And then Friday morning, he calls me. He's like, Dave, it's coming today. And it was coming, and it was already rounding Monterey and on its way, and it was going to be there about 36 hours early. I don't know what that says about the shipping business or what, but it would be hard to schedule. And so he calls all of his friends, all the family. Nobody can come. Everybody's at work. Everybody's elsewhere. And the only guy that can make it in time to see the ship come in is this guy. And so how sad is that, right? But it's always good to have a writer friend because we have no schedule and we never have anywhere to be. So if you need moving done, gutters cleaned or whatever, it's good to have somebody like a writer. So I get there, and about a half an hour later, we see this, which is that ship that you can see. It had just passed the Bay Bridge and was heading for the port of Oakland. And so it was really sort of one of the most moving moments of my life. We're just about out of time, so I'm just going to sum up a little bit and then let Mokhtar sum up. I want to first, before I forget, say thank you to Joseph Fox Books for being here and for existing. Can we just clap? I
I started coming to Philly Free Library like a long, long time ago. And at that point, there was a little bit of doubt whether the indie bookstores would survive. Does everybody remember that moment? And I won't even go into how they survived. There's a lot of giants of the retail industry that fought each other, and they left a little bit of daylight for the indies to survive, and there's more independent bookstores now than there were 10 years ago. So that's pretty good, right? Want to say also, the U.S., the bombs that are being dropped in Yemen made in the U.S., and logistical support is being provided by the U.S. To the Saudis, and Trump is giving the Saudis a free hand to do this. And we have a say as American citizens. We can say that this is unauthorized war that we're participating in. There's going to be legislation hitting a bill being proposed this week. It should be any minute. It might even be tomorrow. So I was told to let that. I know that it's coming. I'm not supposed to say who's sponsoring it or exactly what it says, but it will give citizens a say, and it will be a bill that will attempt to put a stop to Europe's participation in these bombings in Yemen that are helping to cause one of the greatest humanitarian crises of our time. And lastly, if you wanted to help in the meantime, one of the people that helped Mokhtar get out of Yemen was Summer Nasser from New York. She's American, Yemeni American. She has an organization called Yemen Aid that does direct work on the ground. And so if you want to check that out online, please do. Mokhtar, after all this, you're back. You have actual coffee in actual boxes being sold in stores, and real farmers that are sort of seeing hope with you still being able to celebrate their work and distribute it around the world while their country is still engulfed in civil war and chaos. But what happens now? What would you like to say?
I'm really honored to be here to speak to you tonight. I feel that I speak on behalf of millions of people and farmers in Yemen, outside of Yemen. If I can have two things for you to take home tonight, one is that you should have by now fell in love with a country you probably didn't know much about, a country that really helped bring this wonderful drink to life. And the second is that as consumers, we have so much more power than we think. When we buy a cup of coffee, we have the power to uplift someone or exploit them. And when we decide to go cheap on things, someone's gonna pay consequence to that. So when you buy your cup of coffee, you know, hopefully you buy ours at La Colombe, you really, it's important to understand that you, this simple cup can have a huge ripple effect and change the economy of an entire country. This coffee crosses borders and cultures and political hardships and centuries of cultivation to find its way to you. And we're living in one of the most divided times. And I think coffee is an incredible way for us to build community. Coffee houses were places where people had these intellectual thoughts and ideas that changed the world, and they can still do that. And so instead of being this rat race where coffee is something we use to speed up, I think it's great for us to slow down with coffee and have these really important moments and be present with each other's life. The shortest distance between two people is the cup of coffee. And I think coffee is a great way for us to build bridges, not walls. Thank you so much.
Mokhtar Al-Kanchali.
Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.